everyone. On this week's ASF Weekly Science Podcast, I'm going to talk about transition to adulthood in autistic adolescents. If you think I've been ignoring this topic, I really haven't. There's just been such a gap in research in this area. Maybe I have been ignoring it, I don't know. But luckily, there is more and more information about research on improving support for adults. But this transition area is a little bit murky. And I think the statement is now well justified from the study I'm going to tell you about. There is a lot of variability out there about what type of transition services people get. The deeper I got into this issue, I really was so appreciative of all the different ways that researchers are better understanding the experience. They include qualitative interviews, healthcare surveys, and administrative database studies. So when it comes to transition from the landscape of child-based services to adult opportunities, which can be drastically different, there are three obvious things that make families nervous. First is, how do you navigate the services that are out there? Second, how do you learn about opportunities? And three, what role does the parent have? What role the parent has may be more obvious for some families, but less obvious for others. Luckily, this week, the CDC published a study using their ADAM, or Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, to collect information about what is happening in the U.S. community around transition planning for autistic teens and adolescents, what kind of mental health challenges they're experiencing. And this is important because when you're dealing with mental health issues, these things integrate with educational planning and independence. Mental health issues and transition go hand in hand. So understanding mental health challenges is really important to make sure there's a successful transition. So you may have heard of the ADAM network. They're the network that counts cases to understand the prevalence of autism. But it's not just about understanding the numbers of people with autism. The scope of ADAM includes improving the experience of individuals across their lives. They can track individuals from that 8-year-old time when they were counting prevalence to what goes on after that happens. So the catch here is that this information was collected in 2020. We all know what was going on in 2020. So on one hand, it was great because it documented the effects of the pandemic in some of these services. But on the other hand, the data may not represent what was happening beforehand or even now. For example, the study looked at 16-year-olds in the school system. So they were born in 2004 and initially assessed for the prevalence study in 2012 when they were 8. They reassessed these kids in 2020. Of course, not everyone was still in whatever system they were. About 20% had moved somewhere and were unable to be tracked. This was the public school system also, both mainstream and public and special education, but public. And they looked at the presence of ADHD, anxiety, depression, seizures, or OCD in the educational records or the IEP. They also collected IQ scores when possible and looked at adaptive tests and suicidal behaviors or ideations. While the percentages of those with co-occurring psychiatric conditions were more common in autism than in general population, they were lower than expected. Why? Well, it was 2020, so many kids may not have been getting access to mental health diagnosis and care, so they may have been underdiagnosed. There are two sides to that. Even in the pandemic, rates of mental health issues were higher than those without an autism diagnosis. But even so, they may have been underdiagnosed. So again, this gets to the point of, yes, it was during the pandemic, and maybe it wasn't completely representative, but even then, it was still higher than you would have expected. Only 2 out of the 5 ADAM sites that they collected data from reported any student receiving any school-based mental health services, which I know may be shocking to you, but I'm really not surprised at all. Mental health counseling for 16-year-olds in the school system is abhorrent and really desperately needs to change. And this includes those with and without an autism diagnosis. And even if you get outside the school system, mental health support at this age is hard to get. This is no secret, and this is not the first time anyone has noted this. This has been shown over and over again. Mental health support is often sometimes the first thing to go when there are budget cuts that need to be made. When researchers looked at things like race, ethnicity, and intellectual disability, the general trend was that Black adolescents with autism were less likely to have a documented anxiety or depression diagnosis compared to white or Hispanic kids. And I know, putting everyone with different mixed backgrounds into these big buckets of Black, white, and Hispanic is problematic, but still, this is the trend that was seen. This isn't because they have actually less anxiety and depression. It's that they have less documented anxiety and depression, and it means they were either not getting diagnosed or not getting the support that they need. Another difference was based on intellectual disability. Just like other studies, 30% of the sample also had an intellectual disability. And also, like other research, those with intellectual disability were more likely to be female, Black, Asian, or Pacific Islander. If this shocks you, it shouldn't. This only replicates what other studies have found. They were also less likely to have a documented suicidal ideation and also less likely to receive school-based mental health services compared to those with a typical IQ. This could be because it may be harder to diagnose things like anxiety and depression in those with intellectual disability. There are studies, one of which is funded by ASF, to look at better ways to understand symptoms of mental health challenges in those with comorbid intellectual disability. But this is an overall problem. And the racial disparity between Black transition-age youth and white in terms of utilizing mental health supports is also seen in Medicare and Medicaid data. Black individuals were less likely to have a diagnosis of depression, anxiety, and in another study led by Teal Benavides, link in the podcast notes, ADHD or PTSD, and they were less likely to have a mental health support visit. And that's for the 2012 data. That's prior to the pandemic. So this is not something you can blame on COVID. So let's start talking about transition planning in the IEPs. Don't get me started about autistic kids who don't have IEPs, but let's look at the transition plans that were in place for 16-year-olds who were about ready to leave the public school system. There was wide variations in this. So in IEPs, 69% were getting some sort of autism special education eligibility. Not everyone with a diagnosis needs special ed, so I get this. Those with intellectual disability were actually more likely to get extended school year and school-based services, but like I said before, less likely to receive mental health supports. Most had testing accommodations or didn't participate in standardized testing. The good news is that 94% of the students in this age range did in fact have a transition plan associated with their recent IEP. That's supposed to be done yearly, so it was either done when they were 15 or 16. But, you know, during 2020, there were fewer IEPs completed. It was a mess. I'm not even blaming the schools. They didn't know what they were assessing, in what context, or in what situation. It was my experience that even though schools were missing the mark, they were kind of trying. Now, one thing that was noticeable about the variability is that only about half of the IEPs reported that there was a completion of transition assessments and goals in independent living. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they weren't meeting them. They just weren't included in the IEPs because of state or district level factors. This may not have been something that was prioritized for completion. Not all states or districts view independent living as a goal for completion as something to be included in an IEP. Now, I would not end this without some sort of note of help for both families and clinicians who are dealing with transitioned age youth. Pediatrician Kristen Soule from Missouri, who is an authority on this topic, actually wrote a guide for other pediatricians to help them with managing transitions. She and her colleagues suggest breaking up transition planning by age to ensure that the guidance is communicated at the right time, families have the right room to prepare, and it's done in bits rather than all at once. For example, in pre-adolescence, start talking about puberty. Preteen, talk about mood, behaviors, and physical changes, and also start with one-to-one visits or being part of the visits being one-to-one rather than having a parent in the room the whole time. In the early teenage years, discuss steps towards their future, what they want to do and how to get there. And that includes building skills and learning how to live independently if that's appropriate. Don't wait until they're actually 18 to start the transition process. By the time they're 18, it shouldn't be the first time they've heard about these things. Also, pediatricians should consider different domains, again, in pieces, not everything at once. These things include things like relationships, life skills, finances, education, and health. Start early. Coordinate care. Start thinking about their first adult doctor's visit. And if possible, help them learn how to take care of their own health needs. I'm not going to get into the details of every single recommendation, but the link is in the podcast notes. Now, for some individuals with autism that may be able to achieve living independently, there are tools to help families and pediatricians. Of course, they're web-based. They can be accessed so all the information does not have to be absorbed in a single pediatrician visit. There's not one solution to this, and families and pediatricians should use as many different solutions as possible. Those with lower language skills may not be able to articulate their goals or may have different goals than someone with better language or higher cognitive ability. Transition is a challenge for all families, not just those with autism. Thinking about how your child is going to survive out in that world is a big concern, but a bigger concern for families whose children need extra support and help and have to navigate the maze of disjointed services out there. So hopefully you can get some help from this podcast. I'm also adding a link to the Transition Toolkit in the podcast notes. It was published by Autism Speaks, and it really has some fabulous resources and advice as well. So thanks for listening this week.